Happy Thursday to you, everyone. You know, lots going on. The open source rebellion is expanding. Is it a question of may the fork be with you? We've got that and more for you on Tech Strong Gang. Hey, everyone. As I said, happy Thursday to you. Alan Schimmel here for Tech Strong Gang. We've got a core show for you on some excellent topics. As I mentioned, we're going to lead off with something around the open source rebellion expanding. Of course, the fork, may the fork be with you. It's everywhere. We're seeing forks. We're seeing fights. There's a lot going on. Changes aplenty going on in the open source world. We're going to follow that up with some excellent Climate Tech Hub videos and commentary from our own Echo Insights editor, Bonnie Schneider, and she's right here with me. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, Alan.
Welcome.
Thank you.
And then joining Bonnie and I, we're all in our Boca headquarters today. One and only Mike Vizar, Chief Content Officer here at Tech Strong. Mike, welcome.
Happy to be here as always.
And then we're going to do something at the end of the show, ripping a page out of 60 Minutes, as I'd like to say, where our own Andy Rooney, the one and only rascal Bob Resselman, who also does our Roll Bob cartoons. Excuse me. Bob has a, I guess it's a monologue, like what Andy Rooney used to do. If you ever watch 60 Minutes, Bob's going to be talking about DevOps jobs. It's going to be great. We'll run that at the end. But for now, let's jump right into this open source rebellion expanse. So, Mike, I am not your father. But what's going on here?
This is starting to feel like the Star Wars saga, right? Because now we're seeing there's something called Valky that's essentially a fork of the Redis database that's gaining a lot of traction. We wrote a post about it this week, and it's well over 30,000 page views. And of course, now there's a storyline about in the journal talking about maybe HashiCorp, which tried to change its licensing terms. Now,
not tried, did.
Did. Well, so far it seems to be a work in progress as far as I can tell.
Yeah.
And now rumor has it that IBM is looking to buy them because there was a fork of their core code base for Terraform, and those people are starting to gain traction on a project called OpenTofu. And I feel like all this goes back to maybe Elastic, when they changed their terms because they were complaining that AWS was taking all the revenue out of the system and they had the open source project. So that was kind of like the first saga. And now we've kind of moved to the second saga involving Terraform. And now it feels like we're starting to see some acquisitions. And is this the, you know, if IBM picks up HashiCorp, does that get rolled into Red Hat? How does that play out in your mind? And what's this, where's this going to end?
So it didn't start with Elastic either. This has been going on. We've been talking about this, you know, and I lived through this in the security. Mitchell and I lived through this in the security world 20-something years ago. First of all, in regard to Valky, just to be clear, Valky is a fork of Redis because Redis moved off of OSI, an open source institute license, and there's about 6 or 7 recognized licensed by the OSI. And came out with their own Redis commercial license or something, whatever they called it. And those are always fighting words to the open source folks.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're seeing is, you know, the lines of battle are being drawn, right? There's businesses that were operating open source projects that were at the core of their business model, recognizing that they can't make enough money in today's demanding profits at all costs model. And so they recognize they need to change the license to protect their IP and to be more profitable. On the other hand, you have a larger than ever open source community that says, oh no, you can't pull the rug out from under us. God darn it, this is open source. We'll fork. Mm-hmm. And forking they are. They're forking all over the place. And now, interestingly, when you look historically, most forks die on the vine. They wither. What's interesting about some of these forks is that they're getting picked up by the Linux Foundation and other large foundation and not-for-profit kind of open source, excuse me, Bastillons, but, and so they look like they're going to succeed. Mm-hmm. Succeed to the point where IBM's picking up HashiCorp for a pittance or of what it was worth probably, and it's not a done deal, who knows what they're paying. But my suspicion and what I'm hearing people are talking, as some politician says, is that, you know, HashiCorp has lost a lot of valuation over this.
Yeah.
But Mike, really, let's not beat around the bush, right? I don't know how well you guys know the whole history of open source. I know you've been dealing with it forever. The fact of the matter was, up until about 5 or 6, maybe 7 years ago, when you spoke to people about open source business models, there was the people who tried to do support and training, and everyone said that's not enough to make a profitable business. There was one company that people pointed to as the model for open source business success, and that was Red Hat. And IBM coughed up, I forgot what it was, how many billions of dollars for Red Hat. But there really was not other open source businesses that were successful. It changed because of this open core model and everything we're doing. But now we're almost back to that square one. What open source model is successful?
And even Red Hat.
And Red Hat themselves, right.
Its licensing.
Changed, yep.
And Pharrell, and that gave birth to this Rocky Linux thing that seems to be gaining some traction.
Yep.
So it seems to me it's burning like wildfire.
So, yep. You know, and what, I should write a book about open source, because I, as I said here on the show, and I've said it on TechStrong TV, and I've written about it, I view the history of open source. We've had 3 eras of open source. The first I call The Cathedral and the Bazaar, based on that great book. I don't know if you ever read The Cathedral and the Bazaar. Yeah. And that was when Dr. Richard Stallman were, you know, down with the pigs and was very Black Panther-ish, 1960-ish, though it probably happened in the 80s and 90s. And that was kind of a free-for-all. It was a bazaar, like a bazaar in the Mideast somewhere, you know, and anything goes. But, you know, it was very pure. Open source was not to be commercialized. Then we moved to Big Brother open source. Companies like IBM. And just about every successful open source project was really kind of owned lock, stock, and barrel by one vendor who kind of ran that project for their own gain. But that prevented other vendors from participating in that project because they didn't want to do it to enrich their competitor, right? Then we moved to the foundation era, and it was like a golden era. I think we're going to look back on it as the golden era of open source because it was co-opetition. It was the rising tide lifts all boats. It was the, we're going to give you all a great level playing field, and then you can grow from there and take it in, you know, sort of like in Dune Emperor and Dune Messiah. You know, you could go into 1,000 different directions.
Yeah.
And now I'm afraid maybe we're seeing the closing of the foundational era of open source into something else.
Well, IBM and Red Hat have been somewhat friendly with the foundation model, so Red Hat contributes
code
to the foundation. So they might wind up taking Terraform and giving it to the CNCF and have roll it back up into OpenTofu is one outcome that could happen here. We'll see how that goes. But I wonder, is the model that a lot of these companies created just fundamentally flawed? Because it seemed to me every time I talked to one of these firms, it was like, yeah, well, we're not going to actually market what this thing does because we're just going to try to pick off the open source community when they join and see if we can actually upsell services. But they weren't really explaining the value proposition of the thing in the first place.
No. Well, so that model right there, though, that I'm going to pick off from the open source community, so that model works as such. The average open source project, less than 4% of the people involved are actually either contributing code, paying for the license, or even bug testing, right? I mean, doing anything other than being a parasite and using the open source for free. And I don't mean, maybe parasite's a strong word, but non-contributors, just taking. And a lot of them, you know, and that was better than what it used to be at 2%. So if you could get from 2% to 4% or 5%, and it was, you know, at volume, you can, you know, theoretically make a great business. I think people are finding out, A, it's hard to get there. B, it's not enough, perhaps, 4% or 5% of open source users being paying customers and contributors. It's hard to make your business that way. And we you know, so that model's kind of gone out. What really has empowered the open source businesses over the last 5, 6, 7 years has been SaaS. Because what they've all said is, hey, instead of taking this open source raw stuff and having to host it and set it up and configure it and maintain it and update it and blah, 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 just take it from us. We have a hosted version of it that you can use as a SaaS. You just pay us monthly. It's not CapEx, right? And we'll maintain the open source project, the open source product.
I was just going to say a little backstory on IBM is that IBM last year sold weather.com, which I was actually working there when they purchased it. And a lot of people were wondering, why would they even want weather.com? And it was for the data, for the weather data. And then when they announced that they were, you know, sold it to, I think it was an investment banking or another company, they were getting away from that weather and video and that whole model. So it's interesting to see, well, they were getting ready for another acquisition, not even 6 months later.
The trouble with the SaaS platform, though, is AWS turns around, and so does Google, and so does Microsoft, and they basically offer the open source code themselves as a service rather than the people who actually built the thing, and that's where that argument was.
But they're... typically, those offerings are like a poor man's choice, right? They give you maybe 70 to 75% of the functionality at a fraction of the cost or free. If you want the premium, you know, tool set, you go to the company. But there are a lot of people who say, you know what, the AWS version for free is good enough for me.
Right. It's bundled in the enterprise license they bought anyway.
And you just hit the nail on the head. And this is the conundrum that a lot of these companies find, that they're stuck literally between the rock and the hard place. The rock being AWS or Google offering their own hosted version of the open source, be it a stripped-down, less feature-rich version, but good enough for many folks, versus the reality that only 4% potentially you're going to pay anyway, and every one of that 4% who come here to the cloud-hosted hyperscaler version takes you further down from your 4% user goal that you need to be profitable. How do you grow this 4% to 6%? How do you distinguish your product from this product without being insanely expensive? So let me get a tough, it's a tough bit.
Let me ask you this last question then. Are we putting a proverbial fork in the golden open source goose that lays the eggs?
Well, that's what I've been trying to say. I think the golden era of open source, we may be seeing it come to an end. I think we're going to need to see something's got to give. I'll volunteer my two cents, and I'm sure I'm going to catch a lot of arrows for this. For all you people bitching and moaning about that these forks aren't great, that how dare these companies change their licensing, get rid of your T-Rex arms, reach into your pockets, and support the open source community. They need more than just lip service. They need hard dollars. If you're using the product and you value it, put some money into it. Put some resources into it. Do at least bug checking, contribute code, pay these companies. Because if not, I'm telling you, they're going to go the way of the dodo, and I don't know where we're going to go. But if you like open source and the way it works, put your money where your mouth is.
And we'll be back.
Okay, we'll be back in a minute.
Welcome back to the Tech Strong Gang. We are talking about climate tech because, you know, it's really interesting across the country, different regions are popping up as climate tech hubs, even designated by the Biden administration. And one of them isn't so far from our studios here in Boca Raton. It's in Miami. And that really makes sense when you think about it. Miami, a lot of people in this climate world are saying kind of the bellwether of climate change, being surrounded by water. And of course, we've facing all the storms there. So Miami designated as a climate tech hub, one of the this has really taken off and the interest has grown and a lot of companies are moving to Miami from all over the world to focus on this change of this problem of fighting climate change rather. Just recently, there was this incredible conference called Emerge Americas that's been happening for 10 years, and it's grown so much. They have over 22,000 attendees from 50 different countries. And I had the chance to speak with Melissa Medina, who is the CEO and founder of Emerge Americas, about climate tech hubs, Miami, and all the people that are coming from all over the world, plus the interest in AI to solve this problem that we'll talk about right after you hear from Melissa. Hi, everyone. I'm Bonnie Schneider on Lincoln Road in Miami with a special guest, Melissa Medina, who is the co-founder and CEO of Emerge Americas. And it's been a wonderful conference. Tell me about how this all got started.
Thank you. Oh, it's a long story, but essentially it stemmed from a place of passion for this community. Nobody really believed that Miami had a thriving tech ecosystem. So really, my father was a visionary behind it and said, is there anything we can do to help foster the tech ecosystem here in South Florida? And again, once we opened our doors the first year and realized, no, we're going to do this annually and it's going to grow organically year after year. To give you an idea, we expect over 22,000 people over the next 2 days. When we first started, we had around 4,000 or 5,000 in our first event. And even that was double what we anticipated for the first event. So it continues to grow.
What are some of the areas this year that you really focused on?
Yeah, every year we focus on emerging technologies. We're Emerge Americas. And this year we did have a focus on AI and quantum. We talk a lot about investment, entrepreneurship across the board.
I know that this year there's been this climate tech area track, and I report on sustainability for Tech Strong TV. So I'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you're aware of Miami is now a designated climate tech hub. President Biden selected 31 cities around the US to designate tech hubs for a certain vertical. And Miami was chosen as a climate tech resiliency hub. We wanted to make sure we were telling that story at Emerge as well. There are a lot of companies in the sustainability and climate tech space that are now integrating AI into their solutions, which I think is only going to help us find solutions for these climate tech problems much faster.
That's great. It does seem like we're in the right place to do that for sure, being so close to the water. Melissa Medina, CEO and co-founder of Emerge Americas. 10-year mark was it, and it's been a wonderful day. We're here on Lincoln Road in Miami. So, Melissa, what is next for Emerge Americas?
A lot more of what we're doing. What you're seeing at the conference is a culmination of a year's worth of work, and our team works year-round. We host startup pitch competitions. We have an accelerator. We work with entrepreneurs, and we want to continue building that, fostering the ecosystem, and continue to build this conference as well year after year. We're not going anywhere.
That's great. Melissa Medina, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much, honey.
Thanks for joining me on EcoTech Insights here in Miami Beach. I'm on Lincoln Road, and we've been talking to thought leaders in AI, quantum computing, and climate tech. If you'd like to learn more about the intersection between sustainability and technology, I encourage you to go to ecotechinsights.com. I'm Bonnie Schneider. Stay with us. So as Melissa mentioned, a lot of the founders and the people at this conference work in AI. So they're combining their knowledge of AI and using that as a tool to reduce carbon emissions. Now, there's obviously catch 22 with that because AI uses so much energy. Mm-hmm. But AI was the big topic there tied into climate tech. And Miami is just one of the cities. Other cities that are looking for that designation and turning towards climate tech are Boston, another example of one. Yeah.
I think somebody in the Biden administration has a sense of humor because Miami is also one of the Bitcoin capitals of the world, and that's where they consume massive amounts of energy. So,
well, I mean, Bitcoin mining goes on all over the place. But, I mean, the fact about Miami is, you know, Miami's future is to be the Netherlands of the Americas, because you know, you get a king tide down there and it floods pretty bad, really bad. It floods on a lot of high tides even, let alone when a storm comes. Mm-hmm. So we need something. You know, I'm reminded there was a show on Apple TV last year. It was an 8-part miniseries or something about life in the future of climate change. And full disclosure, it was probably produced by someone a little bit on the left side of the spectrum. It was maybe worse. I don't know if it was a worst case scenario, but it was a scary case scenario. And man, what they painted from Miami was not pretty. It was pretty ugly, as a matter of fact. But I think any of the cities along the seaboard, I mean, and remember that, you know, not to sound like a coastal elite, but 80% of the population of this country lives within 100 miles of the east or west coastlines. And so if you get the kind of worst case scenarios of sea level rise, it's bad. So I applaud the Biden administration and I applaud these cities for recognizing they're on the front line.
And they're really bringing in a lot of international talent and ideas to not only deal with extreme weather, which of course has been exacerbated due to climate change, but also ways to reduce carbon emissions through automation and AI. And throughout this week and next, you'll see more interviews like the one I did with Melissa, with other people that are in this space of climate tech. But it is something that is growing. I've just seen it in the past few years where it's, we of course talked on the Tech Strong Gang how Europeans are already doing this. It's part of their mantra, but I see a lot more happening in the U.S. as well.
I was listening to this podcast where this fellow who's a commentator in Ireland, and he had a guest on, and that fellow was saying, if it gets like 3 to 5 degrees warmer along the equator,
we're done.
You'll be able to grow food 100 miles on either side of it, and then if you can't grow food, all those people are going to move somewhere. And so he was going to say, this is going to be a mass migration all due to climate change. So the complexity of this issue is immense because it's not just about whether or not it's too hot.
No. And let me throw a little more cold water, pun intended, on this. You know, I read an article yesterday about Europe, the EU, moving to the right, right? You have a right-leaning, more than right-leaning, you have rightist prime minister in Italy. Mm-hmm. You have, you know, a whole bunch of right-leaning folks, Orban in Hungary, the guy from Poland. But the bottom line is, a lot of the EU countries are starting to walk back from their commitments to climate change and carbon emissions and so forth, because it's hard. It's hard to do, obviously, and they don't feel like the rest of the world is doing their share. So why should they, right, at the sacrifice of business? And you know, I've been looking to the EU as sort of the shining example of what to do, because I still don't think we have the political will. I think if we asked 1,000, you know, U.S. folks, especially here in Florida, what they think of climate change, there's still going to be a sizable percentage who say it's a hoax.
Well, when I did some speeches with my book a couple years ago, I found most of the audiences, at least in Florida that I spoke to, was like 50-50. I had, some people that were completely against the whole concept and some that weren't. But I was just going to say, what's interesting about the tech side of it is that it is true. You get strong opinions on either way. But some of this tech is doing it in almost, not a sneaky way, but a way of attacking climate change maybe that you wouldn't think of. For example, I interviewed an Israeli company that's doing using AI and Internet of Things to prevent traffic jams. And that just at face value might think like, oh, that's nice, they're helping transportation. But when we have a traffic jam, we have all those cars on the road emitting carbon monoxide. So sometimes a lot of these solutions are happening in a way where it's, I don't want to say they're controversial, but it's not as, people might be more accepting because they can relate to it. That seems to be an issue.
Absolutely. I mean, the other thing is, I think the gold rush is on. You know, there was another article we saw on CNBC about the governor of Massachusetts says he wants Massachusetts to be the hub,
right,
of climate change tech. I'm sure he's not the only one. Every city wants to be the hub of, you know, Silicon Valley, Silicon Beach, Climate Change Island, Climate Change Mountain. You know, we'll have all of these things. What's interesting is that has become a real business model that sucks government money. We want to be the Silicon. We want to make chips in the Midwest, and we're going to do batteries in the Southwest, and we're going to do climate hub in the East Coast, and we're going to do another kind of hub over here.
It's the only way out, because I don't think any amount of conservation is going to change the outcome at this point. So we have to find ways to take the carbon out of the environment, because otherwise we're just not going to get there. And even Scotland, to your point, just pulled back on its commitments.
Yeah.
I think it was a couple of days ago. But it's interesting, too, you know, there's a generational issue here. If I go talk to some of my own kids, for that matter, they're pretty hostile about this topic. They are...
Well, it's their life.
Yeah, exactly. And they're kind of like, you know, boomers, you're destroying the earth and you're not doing anything about it. And they're kind of like, you know, what are we going to do? And I'm telling them we're going to tech our way out of it. And that doesn't really resonate too well.
Well, a lot of those tech entrepreneurs I spoke to were younger. I don't know if they're Gen Z, but they were younger, maybe millennials younger. And they are very passionate about it. And they were... international. I guess some were from here, but they do see it kind of what you just said, Mike, about tech will solve it. They seem confident in it.
Well, because they've been raised to think that tech could solve all of our issues.
Yeah.
But let me call the pig in the poke the pig that it is. There's only one faction of people in this country who are climate change deniers. And they are all very old, and they're all basically following one isolationist theory that thinks if they stick their head far enough in the sand, the world will be fine because Jesus will come down and save them or something, right? And the sooner, we just saw the Senate pass some things and the House on aid and everything. We need to take this country back in the center of this country with reasonable people who use common sense and understand this for the problem it is, and we will solve it. I do believe that as a country, as a civilization, as a race, we have it within ourselves to solve these problems. What holds us back are the ankle biters, the naysayers, the flat earthers, and these people who deny.
And there are some companies out there involved in this who make products that this man.
Absolutely.
And they happen to reside in certain states. And so there's also money at play here.
There always is. Mm-hmm. But I'm encouraged that maybe we will see a center take hold here and that, and we do common sense things. Anyway, back to you, Bonnie.
I was going to say, are y'all riled up there? No, I was going to say, it's interesting about climate change. I've been talking about it for several years now, and it seems that the reason I think that when I was mentioning the audience of the reception 50-50, I did a presentation in Miami, was because it's right in front of them. Even the people that you're saying, you know, like, this isn't happening. When it's right in front of you, how can you deny it? You know, you're seeing...
No, they know, but I've heard them just say, well, that's God's will.
Oh, okay.
Right? And we've always had climate change, right? Even during Snowball Earth. I'd like to know where they're going to live during Snowball Earth.
Yeah, well, and it's difficult because it'll pour rain in California and there'll be floods and they'll be looking around and they're going, what are you talking about? We got plenty of water.
But yeah, the issue is...
It's more
extreme weather. I mean, it's really that
that's what it... You know that, right?
Yeah.
You're the meteorologist.
I think that's what it is. But in any event, these climate hub cities that are happening are bringing great talents and great ideas using AI. Hopefully not as too much energy while they're using AI to try to solve these problems in very unique ways. And I'm looking forward to sharing interviews with the people I spoke to everyone watching Tech Strong TV.
So is there a new website in this? Tech Strong Climate Tech? What do you say?
Tech Strong Eco-Tech Insights.
Eco-Tech Insights.
Yeah, I'll be having
Yeah, you know, we have a subset. Hopefully it'll grow into a full site at some point sooner than later. It deserves it. But, you know, there's budgets involved in politics, Mike.
But
we do have ecotechinsights.com. And Bonnie's been doing this for years, and she's been doing it with us now more than a year. So do check that out.
So after you're done funding that open source project, Bonnie needs some funding here.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
That'd be great. Thank you.
All right. On that note, we're going to take a break so we can get some funding. We'll be back here on Tech Strong Gang in a second.
Hey guys, this is JJ Manila with Mitch Ashley, co-host of CISO Talk, where we have engaging bite-sized conversations for current and next-gen CISOs.
You know, we have some of the best conversations on CISO Talk with some of the greatest talent in security. People like Andy Ellis, who talked to us about optimizing security strategies and how to navigate the boardroom. Lisa Bradley came on and talked about vulnerability management, bug bounty programs, and why SBOMs aren't the solution to all your software security problems. Steve Reynolds was also another great guest, and he talked to us about what not to do when a security incident happens.
The what not to do's are great, but we also had Eve Mailer and Steve Bitten on talking about security and third-party software, SaaS applications, and weaponizing AI. So go ahead and join us for the latest episode of CISO Talk. You can find us by going to techstrong.tv/CISO Talk.
All right. And we're back talking about AI once again. And our friends over there at Microsoft have been playing around, and they have this Vasa-1A1 model. Really great on the marketing stuff there. But apparently, you can now take your headshot, a little strip of audio, and they will create something that looks like a talking head, so it's max headroom for everybody. And I'm not quite clear what we're going to do with this thing, but it's kind of interesting that we can all now have digital personas out there. And, you know, is my persona going to talk to your persona and have a conversation and inform us later about what happened? I mean, where does this end?
It's kind of fun. I made one of myself already.
Did you?
I don't use it for anything. But
did you do it with Vasa-1?
No, I did it with another program.
I think Vasa-1 is just sort of a research thing now. I don't think it's actually commercially available. But it is out there. I did a lot of the AI images of myself, too. It was actually before I lost weight, so I got to redo them. But the interesting thing about the Vasa-1 thing is it's one thing to have a caricature or even a deep fake kind of clone of your head and then set it to words. But to be able to make the mouth move in connection to the words being spoken is, I think, the real big thing in Vasa-1 here, in that it's a hell of a lot more, you know, it's like watching a dubbed movie. You hear the guy talking like this, and then it comes out in Spanish, but it does it, you know.
Is this like a real dub movie, or is this like a 1950s?
I'm talking like a 1950s or a spaghetti western or something like that. But no, with Vasa-1, the lips move really with the words, so it looks like they're really talking. But, you know, here's the bigger issue. I read a couple of other articles the last couple of days. If they're going to create a max headroom kind of, you know, caricature of you, clearly it's an AI caricature of you, and I know it's an AI caricature of you, and it looks pretty cool that his mouth is moving, or our mouth is moving, or its mouth is moving with your words, but it's an AI thing, and it is what it is. This deepfake thing, we covered it a few weeks ago with the poor schnook from the bank in Singapore who gave away $20 million. But couple of other articles. There's a bill pending. I think it's in a couple of the states. You know, a popular thing to do in high schools, evidently, right now, is to take pictures of young girls and attach them to nude photos and pass them around. This hit two of the best women's college basketball players, and forgive me for not knowing their names. But the one, she just graduated. She's the all-time leading. Caitlin Clark, and then a woman on the Connecticut team who's really good. Mm-hmm. They both were victims of this. We've got to make that a crime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's got to be a crime, because what it can do to a young person's psyche to be ridiculed and stuff like this is just...
I think it's
just wrong.
I think technically it is a crime on misappropriating your image for, I think you have to do it for a commercial purpose maybe, but we just need to strengthen the laws, but then the enforcement of that becomes a challenge in its own right.
It's a law. It's against the law to distribute it. If the person makes the image and then emails it to someone or texts it to someone, that's illegal, but it's hard to probably figure out who did it to begin with.
Well, we need an AI model to track the usage of the AI model. Right. So that we can, you know.
So the AI is watching the AI. Well, but I'll give you an analogous situation that worked out. You know, when my kids were younger and in high school, the whole issue of sexting started rearing its ugly head, right? So, you know, someone would pass around video or pictures of underage people in nude or compromised or whatever. And very quickly, we clamped down on that. The police clamped down on it and said, you cannot distribute pornographic images of people under 16 or whatever the age was. So I guess, well, might have been different in Tennessee. I don't know.
I don't know.
But very quickly, that became verboten, and it's really, you don't see it as much. I think we got to do the same thing here. When it becomes criminal and you start arresting people.
What happened to simpler times, man? When I was in high school, I was just trying to figure out how to pass the note across the room. Yeah,
and you always got caught. And the note was something stupid, like, do you want to play ball later or something, right? It's a tangled web, you know. Look, I don't, and I say this as a parent, I don't envy kids today. Right? It's tough between, I mean, it's great to have all this technology at their fingertips, right? They don't have the World Book Encyclopedia in their room anymore. But it's a, you know, between dealing with all of this, figuring out what they're going to do for a living, as I think Bob is going to talk to us about at the end of the show today, right? Well, do you want your sons to grow up to be coders? What's going to happen with climate tech and wars and everything else? It's enough to just curl up, you know? I feel like it some days. It's crazy out there.
I think there's a small cottage industry or pharmaceuticals to keep those kids calm, right?
Yeah, there is, unfortunately. And it's not just kids out lynching. Mommy's Little Helpers, I'm thinking of a Rolling Stones song. But anyway, look, it's going to be interesting as AI continues to evolve at that level.
All right, I just want to say
we may be AI.
I just want to apologize on behalf of all the boomers. It's not entirely our fault, but we did the best we could.
Look, we made the little blue pills. Anyway. I'm in a rebel rousing
mood today.
I should be running for office or something. Anyway, can we go now to our next segment?
I think we can.
All right, well, let's take a quick break first here on Tech Strong Guy. Welcome back here to Tech Strong Gang. You know, we've got something completely new for you today. We're going to rip a page out of 60 Minutes. and we have our very own Andy Rooney, who is going to give you a couple of minute overview of something that we think you're going to find interesting. Our Andy Rooney is none other than Bob Resselman. Roll Bob. He's a longtime contributor to DevOps.com and just about everything on Tech Strong. And we wake him up at an ungodly hour because he lives out in L.A. But Bob has a great segment today on DevOps jobs. And, you know, Bob always has great things to say. So let's move over to Bob. Bob, welcome. How are you?
I'm here on a sunny day in L.A., that's for sure.
Beautiful. All right, Bob, take it away.
So DevOps jobs, well, the chickens have come home to roost for all you people that loved Jenkins and said, gee, I can automate my CI/CD and automations, and I can do my unit tests automatically, and I can do everything. Well, guess what? Now AI can do it for you, too. And so all those people that we sort of put on the sideline, so you don't have to run your unit tests anymore, do your deployments, and they sort of figure out, oh, gee, I have to do other things. Now it's beginning to infect everybody. Now it's beginning to infect everybody, myself included. When I program, and I still do program, guess what I'm using? I'm using Copilot. I no longer write code. I say, Copilot, do this very complex task for me. Copilot does it. I check it, and that's that. So what used to take me maybe 2, 3, 4 hours is now taking me 5 minutes. And let's boot it. Copilot's learning what I do. So it's only a matter of time before, gee, I go the way of that guy that used to do unit tests instead of Jenkins. But what's even more interesting to me is that jobs are being changed, but also working conditions are being changed. I find that really interesting. So when I started working back at the age of 16, you know, you got on the subway, you went to work, and you know, you did what the boss told you to do, and you sort of were grateful at the end of the week to get the check, and the government didn't take too much. You know, fast forward to all these years where I have gray hair, and I walk into an office maybe 5 years ago, and there's dogs, and there's caterers, and there's masseuses, and all this stuff. It's like I've died and gone to employment heaven. Well, those days are over. Those days are over. And now we're back. We're back with everybody else doing. If indeed you can still have a job, and if indeed you still have to show up at an office, you're going to be lucky if you get a free lunch. And that's going to change everything. So what does that mean in the long term? Well, let me be direct with you. If somebody were to come to me in their 30s or in their late 20s, right out of school, and they say, what technology job should I be doing? What's my future in technology? I would tell them to become an electrician. It's a small tool set. You have to be on site. They need you. And you can take your electrical engineering or electrician skills with you wherever you go. And it's going to be really hard to automate somebody, you know, cutting those wires and plugging them in. So welcome to the future, guys. Here we are. Alan, it's only a matter of time till it hits you too.
Bob, thank you. Hopefully I'll be retired by then. But it is a scary prop. You know, when I talk to young people now, I tell them the same. This is the first thing I ask them. What's the future look like for them with AI? Anyway, great segment from Bob. That's going to wrap up our Techstrong gang for today. I hope you guys have enjoyed it. Bob, we'll have you back on maybe in another week or so with another great segment. Until then, keep up. You know what? They don't draw cartoons as well as you.
Actually, I've done the test. I do go to AI and I say, here's my cartoon idea. Draw the cartoon and I'm still winning.
I have no doubt about it. They can do some things, but they can't do RoboBob. All right. We're out of here on Techstrong, gang. Stay tuned because we've got a full day of Techstrong TV behind this for you. I hope you enjoy it. We will be back on Monday, actually, with some great new content for you. Until then, great weekend. This is Alan Schimmel. We're out.
SecurityBoulevard.com is the leading resource for news, analysis, and education on challenges facing the cybersecurity industry. SecurityBoulevard.com covers all aspects of cybersecurity, including data security, DevSecOps, cloud security, application security, network security, security threats, and more. SecurityBoulevard.com has the largest selection of security content, featuring breaking news, blog posts, podcasts, and more. Visit www.securityboulevard.com to learn more. SecurityBoulevard.com, home of Security Bloggers Network.